This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. My next guest is Dawn Turner. For many years, she was a columnist at the Chicago Tribune. In 2015, as she said goodbye to her readers, she said she never really wanted to write about race. But eventually, she did, exploring questions big and small. She said it was part of a personal journey to deconstruct why we feel the way we feel when it comes to skin color. Now, in a new memoir, Turner is sharing more of her personal journey on race and the role it played in charting three very different courses for her, her little sister, and her childhood best friend. One would suffer from alcoholism and die in her mid-20s. The other would be sentenced to decades in prison for murder. The girls came of age in the historic Bronzeville neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. Turner writes, "Anything you can imagine or want or hope for is here. The good life, made evident by black politicians, doctors, lawyers, judges, and professors. A good time, as offered by prostitutes, street vendors, and drug dealers. It's all here, not on the other side of the tracks or the other side of a river or even the next L stop. It's just across the street. For generations, Bronzeville has been a place where all that was good and bad is simultaneously at your fingertips, yet a walled-off world away." The book is Three Girls from Bronzeville, a uniquely American memoir of race, fate, and sisterhood. Dawn Turner, welcome to the 21st.
Brian, thank you so very much for having me. I'm just pleased to be here.
I want to begin in Bronzeville. For listeners who might not be familiar, what is Bronzeville's place in the Black American experience?
Yes, thank you. Bronzeville is the cradle of Chicago's Great Migration. My great-grandparents brought my grandmother up in 1916 when my grandmother was 3 years old, and they were part of the first wave of African-Americans leaving the Jim Crow South and heading north to Chicago and other places. And they arrived here believing that this was the promised land, but they were forced to live in this very confined space. And so initially a place that was supposed to offer so much promise began to deteriorate because it was abandoned and neglected. And so they did what a lot of people do under those conditions. They found a way to make a way out of no way. And that set the scene for, because people of various classes and ability were forced to live together, you had this hodgepodge of art and culture and scientific discovery. Dr. Daniel Hale Williams lived there, and he was the first heart surgeon to successfully complete a heart surgery. And you had Ida B. Wells, the great anti-lynching journalist and activist who lived there, as well as Louis Armstrong. And so just so many firsts. It had Bronzeville had the first black hospital, black owned hospital. And insurance companies, you had entrepreneurs, and there was just so much there and so much history. Gospel music came from Bronzeville. The Chicago blues, the way we think of it, came from Bronzeville. So it's just, there's just so much wealth as well as just a very complicated and complex place.
Yeah, and such a direct connection to history. You write about, I believe it was your mom running errands for a woman who had been born into slavery herself. And yeah. So you and your sister, Kim, you're the fourth generation of your family to call Bronzeville home. What was it like when you were growing up? This is after Ida B. Wells and Louis Armstrong, obviously, many years.
Yes. Well, yes. Well, a long time after.
Yes, sorry. I did not mean that.
No worries. But we came of age in the 1970s in the afterglow of the civil rights movement. And it was a moment when our parents believed that this country would finally be amenable to affording us the opportunities that it had denied generations of Blacks. And our parents would soon be disabused of this. But in that moment, they saw just an incredibly bright future for us. And we, in part of that future, in 1968, we moved into a brand new apartment complex that was designed and conceived by a world-renowned Black dermatologist. His name was Dr. Theodore K. Lawless. He had created skin treatments for people with syphilis and leprosy. And he, along with another principal developer, John H. Johnson, the famed publisher of Jet and Ebony magazines, they wanted a place for people who were kind of what they called in the middle. So the community already had Lake Meadows apartment complex, which was kind of for the Black well-to-do, people who would just be there for a while before they would go and pursue that American dream of home ownership. And that was Lake Meadows. And then the other big development in our little nook of Bronzeville was the Ida B. Wells public housing development. And by the time Lawless Gardens was built, the complex was built, Ida B. Wells had begun to deteriorate. And so we were, our housing complex was right in the middle. We were kind of working class people with middle class aspirations. And that was very similar to the way that Deborah's family was as well, that we were kind of all trying to pursue with education and just trying to, we were strivers. Now, of course, there were strivers in the housing project as well as throughout the community, but we were this new kind of cohort or young group that we were supposed to just dream big and just go after those dreams.
Yeah, and I should maybe mention for listeners who haven't read the book yet, Deborah was the best friend, one of the three girls from Bronzeville, along with you and your sister. And we'll come back to her a little bit maybe in the conversation. But you have a line in the book I marked here about, you know, this idea of you have the housing for the very poor and the very well-to-do, and this the Lawless apartments were going to be in the middle. You have this line, Mom had admired Theodore K. Lawless for years, but that name, how unfortunate for a Black development.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, my mother, she had grown up in public housing in the Ida B. Wells homes when that they were built to be an answer to the horrible tenements that came that began to just flourish as a part of neglectful landlords. You know, so as she was coming up, so the Ida B. Wells homes and initially was supposed to be this bastion. And so then, as I said, when we moved into Lawless, they at that point, they had started to deteriorate. And so my mother really wasn't certain that she wanted to move her family. My father grew up in another area of the city, but she was the one who first heard an ad on a radio station about this new development right across the street from the Ida B. Wells homes. And my mother was incredibly, she wasn't sure that this is where she wanted to be. She didn't necessarily want to go back home, even though back home would be across the street. But the development was just beautiful. I mean, the lawns were manicured. The grounds were so well taken care of. There were playgrounds. There were floor-to-ceiling windows in the lobby of the building. There were 24 stories. 10 apartments per floor, and the apartments, I mean, the elevators just, you know, zoomed up to the top, and it was just really just a beautiful building. And so she decided to get my dad and the whole family. And it wasn't just, my sister was a baby at the time, and so it wasn't just the four of us, but it was also my grandmother and my uncle. And so we all moved into the building. And it was just kind of that testament to what they had envisioned for their daughters who were going to, you know, take off and do great things.
If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Dawn Turner, who is the author of the new memoir, Three Girls from Bronzeville, a uniquely American memoir of race, fate, and sisterhood. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. There are a few times in the story where you say something along the lines that one of the earliest versions was, the country will think it knows everything about our neighborhood and us, but it won't. It can't possibly know. And that's a theme that comes up a couple of times. When you were growing up, what did you understand about how outsiders viewed your neighborhood?
Well, you know, I didn't understand a whole lot initially because we were this kind of... we were a little cloistered, or and just kind of cut off a bit. And so cut off not so much logistically or not so much geographically, but our families, our parents, I mean, they sheltered us. And so we were not, we weren't incredibly privy to a lot of the racism. We were not, we knew it was going on because we'd heard stories from our families. But so we were just in this little nook. And it was very, for us, it was very safe and it was secure and it was home. And so it was just our given world. So we didn't understand at the time that the place had a lot of history, didn't understand exactly what that meant, even though my mother would say Gwendolyn Brooks lived here. And I would later come to just, I mean, almost savor those words because I loved her poetry and her writing so much. But we would get snippets of that. But we also didn't understand the role that restrictive housing covenants played on the place, or even redlining. We didn't understand those things because, as I said, it was our given world. And just to go back a little bit about what you said about Theodore K. Lawless's name, I think that one of the things that concerned my mom is that even though she knew that this was a man who was just, as I said before, world renowned and so talented and accomplished and wanted to work outside the field of science, you know, in creating what I would call now, didn't at the time, but affordable housing that was just beautiful. She was afraid that the name would somehow Lawless would mark us in a certain way. But that was the same thing with my elementary school, which was James R. Doolittle. Do you want to go to a school called Doolittle? But that is when there's so much fragility, all of that stuff matters. And so, you know, and at the time, our teachers were very much like our parents in that they saw, it was right after the civil rights movement, and they worked their butts off to expose us to places and things and to have us learn in ways that that may have been a little, that was beyond what had been done before. That they believed in us so much. And so going to Doolittle was very much a Chicago public school and very much a privilege.
How was your consciousness then raised on matters of race, right? You write, you have a couple of, I guess, moments in the book, right? You describe, the television series Roots for one, man who worked at the Chicago Library and started introducing you to more authors. You even describe an experience going out to a friend's house in the Beverly neighborhood, which is a rich or a richer, I guess, not rich, but an enclave of a lot of white firefighters, police officers live there, and being sort of impressed at, you know, all the decorations on the houses and things like that. Right. How was your consciousness raised?
Well, as I said, there was some conscious raising, a consciousness raising in my house. My mother, when she was learning to drive, and she was teaching herself how to drive by following jitney cabs up and down King Drive, a street not far from my home, and she would point out different places of note and these landmarks. And as a kid, you know, you kind of maybe roll your eyes a little bit, not really understand. And I began, I loved reading at a very early age, but most of my books were like the Pippi Longstocking series or some Nancy Drew or Trixie Belden. And I remember when my mother came into my bedroom, I was at school and I came home to find a book by Gwendolyn Brooks on my pillow. And she was like, read this. And it was Maud Martha. And it changed my life. I didn't know, I think it was around the third chapter when there's a street called Cottage Grove that's mentioned. And so I understood that there were people in this book who looked like me, but I was astounded to find people that it was set in Chicago and in my neighborhood, And it was about people who lived like me. And so that was like one of those moments. But it really wasn't until my stepfather, when my mother remarried, and he worked as a security guard in a library, in the main Chicago public library downtown, this big behemoth of a building that had these wonderful old and briny books. And he would, you know, we'd go down to the library, but he would also bring books home to me. And that was just, that really opened my eyes. Reading work by James Baldwin and more Gwendolyn Brooks, and just these authors that I'd heard a little bit about, but just reading their words really changed my life. And then the show Roots, I had planned to watch it that night. We were initially, you know, something that we were told to watch. And that night we had dinner and I was sitting in front of the cocktail table. Everybody else was behind me on the sofa. And so I'm sitting in front of the TV screen and I have an Archie comic book because I'm thinking, I'm just going to read this comic book as everybody else watches this. But I was transfixed from the beginning, and soon the comic book just kind of slid down to the floor somewhere. And I just loved learning about people, learning about a part of my history that I'd heard little snippets about, but this kind of, I mean, it was a fictionalized version of something that happened, and it was just completely immersive. And it really did. And I know a lot of people felt this way, Black people and white people, that it changed their lives.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Dawn Turner. She's the author of the memoir, Three Girls from Bronzeville, a uniquely American memoir of race, fate, and sisterhood. She had been a columnist at the Chicago Tribune for many years before that. We need to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation when we come back. Again, if you want to join our conversation, if you have a question for Dawn Turner, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. More to come with Dawn Turner. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Dawn Turner, who is the author of the new book, Three Girls from Bronzeville, a uniquely American memoir of race, fate, and sisterhood. She's also a former longtime columnist at the Chicago Tribune. And if you want to join our conversation, the number to do so is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. So you have such an eye for detail, and you reconstruct moments in the book from decades ago, not just snippets of conversation, but I was struck by the sound of your father's 64 DeVille starting up, you know, the smells of cocoa butter and camphor among the women in your family, and the opening narration of the $6 million man, right? We can rebuild him. How did you go about reconstructing the detail?
Well, some of the detail comes from just old stories that I heard growing up. And I just feel like, well, I went to college to be a doctor, but I feel like there was somewhere in me from the very beginning a storyteller and a writer. And it's part of my DNA, I think, because I come from, just like a lot of people, we come from people who tell stories. And so I kept journals and I kept diaries. And later on, I would just keep things on little scraps of paper. And then the whole idea of talking to people, I just love listening to my mother, my grandmother and aunt. The men told really wonderful stories too. But I remember being very young. And I mean, some of it is my memory and some of it is from just things that I was told. But my sister and I do remember this, we would hide under the table, the dining room table, and just eavesdrop on the women talk after dinner. And they had perfect pitch. They had this wonderful knack for creating characters that were just robust. And, you know, it's just like, I felt like I want to do that. I want to do that in some way. And so that's how and then as a journalist, I'm so used to interviewing people. And I didn't want this book to just be about my memory, but I pored over court documents. I talked to former classmates, even elementary school classmates with whom I'm still in touch. And so I just kind of, it was my effort to get as close to the truth as I possibly could.
I want to ask you about your time at the Tribune. How many columns were you writing, 2-3 columns a week there?
In the beginning, I wrote a column for about a decade and a half. And I had my standard column, but I would also fill in for my amazing colleagues, Mary Schmeich and Eric Zorn. Okay. And then I started to write a column about health and wellness, and I had for a while a forum that was online, but it was also a column about race, and it was called Exploring Race. And just now this conversation seems like something we've had forever, but back then it was started when Barack Obama won the Iowa caucus. And I just wanted to have a conversation about race, and we did that. And then in latter years at the Tribune, I wrote a column that ran 3 times a week.
Yeah, and I guess one of the things there's so many directions I kind of want to go on that. I'm going to just pick one though. Being a columnist it's one of those jobs that strikes me as an outsider as something that's both an enormous privilege and an enormous burden, right? You constantly have that next deadline. How did that feel to you?
Well, it was absolutely a privilege. The challenge though, is that when you write about race, and I didn't write every column about race, but I wrote enough of them that it was the case where sometimes readers would complain before they even read the column. And maybe they would complain about a column that had nothing to do with race. But the burden is, you know, and everybody has this when it comes to a job. I mean, there are just days when you have to really dig a little deeper for the story or for what it is you want to say about a topic. And that's just part of the deal. It's an amazing vehicle. And I think that it was just so important for me to write about different things. And I just kept coming back to race because it's a big part of my life and a big part of what's going on in this country and what has been for a long time.
Yeah. And on that note, and related to something else you said earlier, you mentioned going to school to be a doctor, and you attended the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, which is one of the stations where this show is carried. We're based at the station at U of I. And you write that when you got there, African Americans made up only 3.4% of the student body. What did that feel like?
It feels like it was a little less than that, but
I thought that was from in the book, but it felt less. Yeah.
Because it was very difficult. Many of us had come from communities that were fairly homogenous. And I had grown up in an all Black community. My minister was Black, my pediatrician, my dentist. And my high school, it was a little bit more, I had a little bit more interactions with people who were not Black, but it really wasn't until I got to college that I lived with my white peers. And I say in the book that before that, what I really knew about my white peers, I had learned from the Brady Bunch and, you know, how much can you learn about people from a television show? But my fear was what they knew or thought about me was what they had seen on their 10 o'clock news of Black people. And so we were able to have conversations and get to know one another. And that is the beauty of diversity and inclusion on college campuses. And so I think it was a great opportunity to do that. I mean, there was also the African-American Cultural Center. It was called the Afro-American Cultural Center at that time. And it was wonderful to also, so to be on campus, but also to have a place that was a bit of a haven where I could go, where race was not something that we, you know, it was different there at the center. So that was just a huge asset on campus.
We've come this far in our conversation, and I should remind listeners we're speaking with Dawn Turner, who's the author of Three Girls from Bronzeville, a uniquely American memoir of race, fate, and sisterhood. And we haven't talked too much about the other two girls that are so important to this story. And that's been somewhat intentional on my part. I don't want to spoil too much for listeners or who haven't, you know, had the chance to read the book yet, but I do want to talk a little bit and start with your sister. And there's so much that unfolds in the course of the story. I don't want to ask you to relive all of it now, but maybe we can just say there was a miscarriage that's a pivotal turning point maybe in her life. Ultimately, she dies at the age of 24. It seems like you and your mom have long struggled with the question, could we have done something differently? Can you talk about what role writing this book played in that process for you?
Yes, I think because, you know, there are young people who, when they enter this world, and this breaks my heart, they're almost doomed from the beginning. And that's because of so many different reasons, so many pressures bearing down on them. But that was not our story. That was not Deborah's story. It was not mine, nor my sister's. We had this incredible network. And our parents divorced when we were young, but we always had access to my father. We knew where he was and you know, called upon him. He was always, for the most part, he was always available to us. And so the vexing question here is what happened? It's what happened to Kim, what happened to Deborah? And it's something that I had tried to, and have tried to pursue in my journalism, in my novels. And it's with this book that the memoir that I tackle it head on. My mother still has not read the book, and I believe in part, I mean, she's such a tough cookie and a wonderful human being, but I know that it's incredibly difficult to relive this, to excavate all of those feelings and memories. So that is, it's a story that I have been grappling with and trying to pursue as a journalist. I love talking to people who were able to transcend pain. I love talking to people who were able to make the most of a second chance and who were able to just do so much in their communities with so few resources. So it's very clear the imprint that my sister and my best friend had and have on my journalism. But I saw this story as something that I really needed to just go back and revisit and try to tease my way through it and try to figure out what the story was. I should say, try to tease out and try to figure out what the story, the meaning behind all of this. And that is the book you have before you.
And were you able to find any more peace about those experiences?
Yes, because I think for the first time I got a chance to interview/interrogate people close to the story, and not in a veiled way, but a very straightforward way. And so I can honestly say that, is it closure? I'm not certain that you ever fully get that, but I do get a level of peace from having having just gone so far into the intricacies of the story, trying to understand it. I learned so much about myself, so much about my sister and my best friend. And so, yes, it was a great experience.
And I also do want to ask you about your best friend, Deborah. She lived just upstairs when you were children. Then her family moves her to Indiana shortly before high school. Eventually, she becomes addicted to drugs and kills a man with whom she was using and is sentenced to decades in prison. And I should say, she's out now. She went to college while there and is out of prison now. But you wrote about her a few times in the Tribune, and you say that readers and colleagues would say how lucky she was to have me as her friend. And that's a sentiment you found offensive, utterly offensive, you say.
Yeah.
What did people not understand about you and Deborah?
I think fundamentally they didn't understand that Deborah and I were very different in ways, but we are also very fragile in the sense that I always say that the story is one about that hinges on there but for the grace of God go I. And I'm hoping that if this pandemic that we have all endured, it's taught us anything, it's taught us that we can't control everything. And so you never know what you can try to do everything right, and still something can befall you, something horrible can happen. And that is what happened with Deborah, and I saw that firsthand. And so for people to say that I was lucky to have her as a friend, they assumed there was an underlying assumption that, you know, that she was a bad person. In fact, the very first piece that I wrote on her in 2000 in the perspective section of the Tribune, there was a graphic that accompanied the story of two apples. No, I'm sorry. It was one apple that had been cut in half, and one was rotting and the other one was pristine. Hmm. And I thought, you know, you guys just don't get it, because my fate could have been hers and her fate could have been mine. And it was just, even though we all think that we do the right thing or we make the better choice, there's so many other forces at play that we never know, you know, where, what can happen.
Well, Dawn Turner, I want to thank you so much for joining us on the 21st today and talking about the book. I should say I really enjoyed reading it. It's a compelling read. It's heartbreaking at times. There's also humor in it, though. And I would heartily recommend it to our listeners. It's called Three Girls from Bronzeville, a uniquely American memoir of race, fate, and sisterhood. Dawn Turner, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that is all the time we have for our program today and this week. Before we go, I do want to urge you to visit our website, 21stshow.org. There you can listen to past segments or share them with your friends if you think somebody would like to listen to something we've talked about on the show. You can also subscribe to our podcast from there, or you can just find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One, wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for The 21st. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Erica Scalise is our engagement producer, and our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again next week.